Let us say that you say to someone, Heraclitus, ancient Greek philosopher. Most folks will say, who? Be honest, most of you probably said who, too. Maybe some of you thought a squared plus b squared equals c squared, but that, of course, is Pythagoras, also a pre-Socratic philosopher, but a different one. Some of you, though, probably did recognize Heraclitus, maybe the responsive reading you saw the author, Heraclitus, and you remember what you might remember about him is this phrase, you never step into the same river twice. That Heraclitus is the philosopher of flux, of change. That in contrast to Plato, who believed in the eternal forms, the essential stability of the essential things, Heraclitus believed that everything was always changing, that the river flows by. And because the water has moved and changed, the river is changed, and thus you never step into the same river twice. And so we sang river songs this week. I've got a river flowing in my soul. O flowing river, flood of life, whose source we cannot see, for one fleet season, pour your stream unbounded into me. But when I was researching for this topic, I found out something shocking. Heraclitus never said that. He never said or wrote, you never step into the same river twice. Plato said that Heraclitus said that, but in the surviving writings of Heraclitus, no such phrase appears. What Heraclitus did say is this, potamisi tosin adatosin emboisin herata kai herata hudida epiri. You got that? Any of you speak ancient Greek? Here's the translation. On those stepping into rivers, staying the same, other and other waters flow. On those stepping into rivers, staying the same, other and other waters flow. Well, what does that mean? It means that the way that the river stays the same is because the waters flow. I step into the river, which is the same river, but the water changes. And indeed, it is only because the water changes that it is a river. If the water didn't flow at all, it would be a pond or a dried up riverbed, actually. But as the author of the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy puts it, if this interpretation is right, the message is not that all things are changing and so that we cannot encounter them twice, but something much more subtle and profound. It is that some things stay the same only by changing. One kind of long-lasting material reality exists by virtue of constant turnover in its constituent matter. Here, constancy and change are not opposed, but inextricably connected. A human body could be understood in precisely the same way as living and continuing by virtue of constant metabolism. On this reading, Heraclitus believes in flux, not as destructive to constancy, rather it is paradoxically a necessary condition of constancy. In general, high-level structures supervene on low-level material flux. That's the end of the quotation. You get all that? All make sense? The point is not that nothing is ever the same from moment to moment. The point is instead that everything is changing from moment to moment, and that's how it exists. The river, the person, the stars, anything that lives, the earth itself, the low-level flux is what sustains the high-level structure. And if you know anything about biology or chemistry or physics, you know that Heraclitus, who wrote almost 3,000 years ago, had it right, and that Plato and his eternal, unchanging forms had it wrong. Everything is in flux at the basic level. Chemical reactions sustain the sun, our own bodies, all living things, the cells of every living thing, and all the parts of every living ecosystem are always dying and being created. And at the level of physics, of subatomic particles, those quarks, those basic building blocks of protons and electrons and neutrons, those quarks are always vibrating, moving, If they stopped moving, existence would cease, which would be bad. Constant, low-level flux is what makes existence possible. So all our songs about rivers are all still appropriate and still right. Indeed, they are even closer to the meaning. There's a river flowing in my soul, and it's telling me not that I don't exist. That'd be a much more Buddhist reading, actually, and the subject for another sermon. No, it's telling me I am somebody. But it isn't that you're always the same person that makes you have a soul. It's that the spirit, the river, the energy of life flows in and through you and gives you your soul power, your existence power. Flowing river, pour yourself unbounded into me. The ages fall like rain. And it is this ever-flowing source which gives life its joy, its power, its life itself. We ask that this power come unbounded into me. And of course, if you're going to talk about subatomic flux, about how everything is in motion, well, that naturally leads us to talk about Heisenberg, the physicist, Werner Heisenberg, after whom the fictional Walter White took his alias on Breaking Bad, which is a reference some of you may get. Why the alias Heisenberg? Because the scientific insight means that we don't know what we think we know. There are things we cannot know. And what better alias for a chemist who doesn't know what he is or what he is becoming or what he has unleashed? But we want to talk about the real Werner Heisenberg today. The common interpretation of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is that you can't know the velocity of a particle and the direction at the same time. If you try to measure how fast it's going, you'll disturb where it's going. And if you try to measure where it's going, you'll disturb how fast it's going. But as the article that I shared with you indicates, this common understanding is wrong. Werner Heisenberg gave two reasons why there are limits to our ability to know about particles. And one reason is that our efforts to measure them change them. So we couldn't know more than one thing about a particle at the same time. The second reason is that the actual location and speed and direction of a particle isn't actually known. That the particle is itself indeterminate. That it doesn't exist in a particular place, but exists in a range of places all at once. The first reason, the one about measurement, is a lot easier to get a handle on, right? Since Galileo, if not before, the idea of modern science has been more and more information, that if we could just measure everything exactly and know how it works, well, then we would know what was going to happen next, exactly. And then we would know what would happen after that, and after that, and after that, and then we would know the future. And then Heisenberg comes along and says, no, you can't measure that without changing it. And so, of course, the effort since has been to prove him wrong, to say, no, we can get so good at measurement that we can solve this problem. And it looks like that might be possible, so far as measurement goes. But the second problem is much harder. The claim is that the limits to measurement are not fundamentally about the quality of our instruments. We can't know because the particle itself doesn't know, doesn't exist in one place, but in multiple possible tracks at the same time. This is a little harder to understand. Quantum mechanics, quantum particles, don't work like other things, things we can plot and measure. I'm gonna give you a very simple explanation, but basically it's because they're made up of those vibrating quarks. And we can have a sense of the range of their location and speed and direction and so forth. But within that range of indeterminacy, the particle has probabilities, but not exactness. Imagine it this way. Two people, and they are famously called Alice and Bob. Einstein called them Alice and Bob. They are observing a particle, and the particle is spinning. And Alice observes that it is spinning at a different speed than Bob observes. Who's right? They both are, and neither of them is. The particle's rate of spin exists within a range of speeds, and Alice and Bob have isolated two of those values within that range, but there are many more possible values, and they're all right and all wrong, because the particle is spinning at different speeds at the same time. Sort of. It's more complicated than that, but that's the basic idea. You got it? It's okay if you don't. It's pretty complicated, but I hope that you get the basic sense of it. Now, don't try this at home. You cannot say to the police officer, "You only measured one speed in my range of speeds. And I was also at the same time going the speed limit." It only works with subatomic particles. And not even your smart car is that small. The point of this is that there are things about which it's not just that we can't know, but there are things which are not known. The unknown is real. It's in nature, not just in our ability to measure. Okay, so what? You might wonder. That's fascinating or mind-numbingly boring, depending on your perspective. What does it all mean? Heraclitus's idea that everything is in flux, and it is this flux that gives everything its life, its power, and creativity. Heisenberg's idea that particles exist and move in ways that cannot be known no matter what. What does that mean? What in particular does that have to do with religion and spirituality? It's a good question. If we take these ideas seriously, and I think we should, if we take these ideas seriously, it will lead us to rethink our most basic ideas about both theology and anthropology. It will inform what we think about the ultimate, about God, the spirit, whatever you call it, and it will inform what we think about life and our lives in particular. Theology first. Now, many of you don't find the concept of God or an ultimate power to be important or useful to you at all. So me talking about a different way to understand God may not interest you very much, but I hope that you will hang with me, if only so that you have one more reason to find the classical orthodox definition of God to be unscientific, and you can pull this card out with the others next time you get into an argument. But for those of us who reach for some concept of ultimacy, some spirit of life and love, the idea of flux and change and indeterminacy have produced a whole new way of thinking about divinity. And this is called process theology. A creation first of Alfred North Whitehead, a mathematician who immediately understood how quantum mechanics changes the meaning of God. The classical definition of God is fundamentally Platonic. It takes Plato's ideas of the eternal, unchanging form and says that God is the most eternal, most unchanging form of all, the thing that is always the same and doesn't change in any way. But as Heraclitus argued and the science shows, high-level structures have constant low-level change. The process theologians put it this way: God changes. Oh, the high level is constant. God is always loving, always present. But because God is related to all that is, they say, and all that is always changing, then God is changing too. The process God can be related to individuals in a way that the classical God, remote and unchanging, unrelated, cannot. It just sits there. Process God is something different. A few of the key process theologians of the last century have been Unitarians. Most of the rest have been Methodists. And I would say that almost all Unitarian Universalists who find the idea of God useful mean it in this sense of a changing, relational God. Heisenberg's theories also explain why God does not, in fact, know the future. The future is a set of probabilities, not an exact linear course. You can't know where the particle really is. Not even God knows, because the particle isn't really in one place. And so how things will turn out, it's uncertain. From this follows the second implication, and this one matters if you believe in God or if you don't. So if you turned out for a couple minutes, come on back. The anthropological meaning of living in a universe of flux and change and unknowns, it means that we are free, that we have some free will, that things are always changing, us included, and all the universe from top to bottom, seed to galaxy. We ply these starry seas, neither harbor nor port do we know. The old dream of science is that we would know everything, the location and the speed of every particle and how everything would interact. And once we knew that, we could predict everything and we would know the future. And since our brains are just chemical reactions, since everything is particles, we would know what we and others would do in any situation, and our ability to predict would be perfect, which is to say, we would have no freedom. No freedom. The theory would go that what feels like a choice to us isn't, because what we will do is already determined by the subatomic makeup of our cells. If every particle in everything, including every living thing, is determined, its course and reactions set nothing more than very small billiard balls, then everything, top to bottom, seed to universe, is determined too. And then we are not free. This is the old dream of theology, too, that God had already set the course, knew all that would happen, and that it all went according to his plan, and we mere mortals had no power over it at all, already decided. But if everything is flux and change, if at the particle level quantum indeterminacy is the way of things, well, then nothing is fully determined. There's a probability and a range. There's not complete freedom because the frequency of the vibration is finite. I'm not free to become a giraffe or a race car, but I am free to think and feel and love and build a better world. That's all within the range of freedom. And that fundamental freedom exists no matter how much we measure about people or particles, because the unknown, the unsettled, isn't a matter of measurement. It's the fundamental reality of the universe and the fundamental reality of our own existence. We are free. And this freedom is our great gift and our great responsibility. We can nudge the vibrations of life toward more beauty and joy and justice, or we can nudge those vibrations toward more selfishness and misery and boredom. That choice isn't determined by the particles bumping into each other in our brains. It's determined in part by us, by our will. In part, for our subatomic realities, the truth of the rushing river is that we are in this way also connected to all that is, drifting here with our ship's companions. This is the last and most important truth of flux and change and the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Everything is connected. The river becomes the sea, becomes the ocean, becomes the cloud, becomes the snowfall, becomes the stream, becomes the river once again. Our choices affect the range of possibilities for others as theirs do for us. Subatomic particles slip out of their orbits, leave the skin of our bodies, float in the air, enter the lungs of others, plants, and grasses, and stones, and all living things, and stardust. From the seed of the universe bloomed 15 billion years ago with a possibility of us inside it. All connected, all part of one living, breathing, changing whole with freedom yet to become, to keep becoming, to keep planting and growing. Our original ideas about Heraclitus and Heisenberg were both wrong. Heraclitus didn't say the thing about the river, at least not in the popular rendering. Heisenberg's guess that it was a measurement problem is not true. And that is another piece of good news, that we can keep learning, that we can correct our errors, that science keeps marching on. I'm sure that when I give a version of this sermon 10 years from now, we'll know a lot more than we do today about how this all works. Because things change. Knowledge grows, justice grows, freedom grows, life grows. We give thanks for growing understanding. We give thanks for the insights of science and philosophy. We give thanks for a vision of the holy that is relational and not apart. We give thanks for the universe of flux and change. We give thanks for not knowing everything. We give thanks for freedom, for the range of possibilities, and commit ourselves to use our freedom for good, for a world of love and hope, for a world of peace. We give thanks for our ship's companions, for community and interdependence, and how everything is connected. We give thanks for our home, this earth forever turning, forever turning, forever becoming, forever changing. Let us sing. I invite you to rise.